It's the High Cooking Corner on 101.9 High FM.
Good morning and welcome to the Cooking Corner. I'm Sharon Lurie, the Kosher Butcher's wife, and thank you for joining me today. Well, I must say it was lovely to see Stan Matthews in the studio just now. Takes me back to when my boys used to play soccer. What a wonderful interview. Well done, guys. So, I actually must say that I feel like I've been on a month's food leave with all the Yom Tovim contributing, of course, to my journey as I traveled from last year into this year. So, starting off, of course, with Rosh Hashanah, New Year, as it's a subdued time for us, one of introspection and soul searching. It's not a new year where we sort of go out and throw streamers and have liquor and kiss each other happy new year. No, it's more of a quiet time with family and introspection. And of course, this was followed by Yom Kippur. And just one day to give us a bit of time to breathe and not have to eat. Actually, there are two fasting days in between. But however, Yom Kippur was followed by Shabbos, big Shabbos meal. A day later, we had Sukkot for 8 days. So that's another 7-8 days of eating. So it's been quite a fulfilling month, should I say. So, you know, it was actually funny because during this period, this time, you bumped into anybody in the supermarket or you chatted to somebody on the phone or friends phoned or whatever, and they, what are you making for Yom Tov? And every year I say the same thing, as I've said to all of you before. I just want to try and keep it simple and just give them what they like and, you know, give them what works and what I know everybody enjoys. But somehow, a new recipe or two or three or four creeps in. And so although you need to keep up with the trends and you need to see what's going on out there and new products and new recipes, you still want to try and keep it traditional. So this year, I have to say, one of the hottest sellers was my daughter-in-law, Rochi's whole wheat challah. Oh, my word. Then there was also a wonderful chicken sushi salad that I made. And such a simple, but went so fast, was a roasted, it was just a beetroot salad, which I will give you the recipe for. Of course, we had the ulala ice cream, which I gave you the recipe for before Yom Tov. So let's start off, before we go to the break, with Rochi's whole wheat challah. So, in fact, it's something that you can make every Shabbos. It's not just a Yom Tov treat. So, what we do is you take 5 cups of warm water, 2 tablespoons of rapid rising yeast. Now, 2 tablespoons would actually be just two sachets. 1 cup of brown sugar. Now, I used honey because I think I ran out of brown sugar, and just because it was more sort of symbolic on Rosh Hashanah for us to have honey, so I put honey in it just as well. 1 cup of oil, 3 tablespoons of salt, and then plus minus about 8 to 10 cups of brown flour. Now, you can use brown flour. You can use nutty wheat. I used the nutty wheat only because that's what I had in my cupboard. In fact, my freezer. I keep nutty wheat in my freezer because, you know, get hohos. So keep it in the freezer, but then bring it back to room temperature before you're going to make the challah. So I threw everything into the bowl. The water, the yeast, the sugar, the oil, and then finally the salt and flour. I don't like to put salt and honey or salt and sugar together because, you know, the sugar I put closer to the yeast. But salt kills yeast, so you must sort of put it at the end, you know, when you put the flour in. Throw it all into a bowl and mixed it with a wooden spoon. So this is actually a great recipe for a yontif where you're allowed to cook, and it doesn't require the use of anything electrical. And I just sort of blended it all together, and it's a very soft dough, but such a lovely, easy recipe. And you can't plait it, okay, like a regular challah. So you'd have to use a round tin or a loaf tin or even those wonderful tins that you can get that are in the shape of a challah. I used that. I have one of those tins. And then all I did was I baked it at 170 for 1 hour and 10 minutes. And I must admit, the first batch that I made, I undercooked, and the family no doubt shrieked in disbelief, but that's them, you know, because they found a little bit of uncooked at the bottom of the challah, but never mind, we toasted and we turned it into beautiful whole wheat Melba toast. But the second one, I think the problem there was that it was just too much in the little loaf tin, so it was a bit too dense. So you should try and get about two large or maybe three medium-sized loaves of bread. So that was a hit, and I hope that it will be on your Shabbos table this week. And of course, I have some other recipes to share with you after the break.
An army marches on its stomach, and so does a community. Join Sharon Lurie Tuesdays at 11 a.m. for the Chai FM Cooking Corner. Come hungry.
I think I'm going to have to do a new promo, Craig, because they call me Sharon, and it's actually Sharon. So we'll get on to that. But thank you for joining me. I'm Sharon Lurie, the Kosher Butcher's wife, and you have tuned into the Cooking Corner, and I've just been sharing a recipe, Rochi's whole wheat challah, which was absolutely delicious, and another new recipe, which was quite easy, just sort of sneaked onto the table. So I'm going to share that recipe with you. It is a beetroot, onion, and eggplant salad. And why it's so easy is that everything either comes in a little tub, can be bought, or can be you can use a bottle of whatever you need to use, except of course the assorted lettuce leaves or the spinach, but that's easy enough. So what you need is 250 grams of baby spinach or assorted lettuce leaves. So you can use butter lettuce leaves or lovely purple leaves. And one large bottle of sliced beetroot, drained. Not the grated beetroot. Must be the sliced beetroot. And you drain it well. Now, there's a little tip here. If you want to, you can keep some of the juice if you want a pink dressing. However, I always think that a white dressing, an eggplant dressing and mayonnaise over this just looks so striking and lovely. So one bottle of sliced beetroot drained well, one large or two medium-sized red onions, the purple onions, sliced very thin into rings. You'll need 500 grams of grilled eggplant salad. Now, this is available at most delis, at most kosher butcheries, that they have the sliced brinjal salad. It's not the eggplant with the mayonnaise in. This is something else. So you'll need 500 grams of the eggplant salad. Sometimes they have a little bit of chili in it, but it's the raw eggplant baked and cooked. Then you'll also need 250 grams of eggplant mayonnaise salad. Okay, so this is also available at most delis, and it's, I think, Farm Salad or and Friends. They all make this wonderful eggplant mayonnaise salad. You'll also need half a cup of water and half a cup of vinegar. So, in fact, what's happening is your eggplant mayonnaise, your water, and your vinegar are the dressing. Then you'll need a bunch of fresh coriander just for decorating. You can use parsley if you have, if you're one of those 10% of people who have an aversion to coriander. I love coriander. It has to be fresh. And then you'll need about a third of a cup, just a little cup, bucky of pomegranate seeds. So now what you do is you ensure that the beetroot is well drained. You place a layer of spinach or lettuce leaves on a nice big round platter. And why I like it round is because the beetroot is sliced in rings, so you can, you know, put that around nicely. The onions are sliced into rings and the eggplants in rings. So you place a layer of the spinach and the lettuce leaves on a round platter, place a layer of beetroot on top of the lettuce. You can make it slightly overlapping in a circle. And then you place the eggplant salad on top of the beetroot, you know, going slightly in towards the center. And then you top it with the thinly sliced onion rings. You know, separate the onion rings and just put them around the plate. And then you combine your eggplant mayonnaise with half a cup of water and half a cup of white wine vinegar, or just white vinegar is fine. Mix it all well together. It should be quite a nice, thick sort of salad dressing. Just drizzle it over the top, and you can decorate it with fresh coriander and the pomegranate seeds. Now, I must tell you, the vibrance of the green leaves and the red beetroot and the purple onions and that white dressing and the ruby red sparkling pomegranate seeds, it's just so eye-catching and so pretty. So this month I contributed some recipes to Jewish Life magazine, and they're actually all about the roll. Yes, the R-O-L-L. Rolled recipes symbolizing our Please God smooth roll from last year into this. And there'll be recipes for drum roll pea soup and pinwheel pierogan, cannelloni yoni, a roll of beef, there's deli roll as well, chicken roll-ups, chicken mayo and lettuce wraps, and roly-poly pudding, which is nice and reminds one of the old days. So I have to admit as well that I did a Rosh Hashanah salad that proved to be such a hit with the chicken roll-ups. And I actually made them look like sushi. So, and I put that on a layer of sushi. But I'll give you that. I'll give you that recipe a little bit later, if we've got time. But Yontif time is actually always a very, very, very busy time of the year for all, especially for writers and caterers and cookery teachers and just for hosts preparing all those weeks of food. And, you know, with the, between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, Sukkot and all those days when, Bev Goldman, I think she's with the Board of Deputies, phoned me and called to ask me if I wouldn't mind being on a panel with Sharon Glass and Karen Menlamert, with Sherry Shakanovsky as facilitator, for the opening of the Jewish Book Week this week. It was such a wonderful, it was like time out for all of us. Just a wonderful reprieve. Just no cooking for that morning and a chance just to catch up with the girls. So for those who weren't able to make it there, just a little taste of how it went.
How do you decide which of the many, many recipes that you must all be equipped with? How do you decide which ones go into your book? Is it a question of, I mean, obviously you're all publishers, you know, every writer wants to sell their books. Do you try and guess what's, you think your audience will be, your readership will be interested in, or do you just think, you know, stuff it, I'm going for my favorite stuff and we'll take it from there? And which, for somebody like you who's published so many cookbooks, which system works better? Should we start with you, Sharon?
Okay, so what I did was, I just gave all the different options and different recipes for the different cuts of meat. So, you know, they could have a look and see, well, okay, I'll do this raisin rib recipe and whatever. And then the second book was more about the Yom Tovim and the different foods that I did for Yom Tov. So I knew basically what I wanted to put in it. And then I have 25 judges. They are my brothers, my sisters-in-law, my cousins.
Very critical judges, I'm sure.
Grandchildren. And they just sort of go quietly like this. They'll just go,
judges.
Not for the book.
How is it for you too?
Well, when I started writing recipes, I didn't think of what people would like. I cook what I like. I'm actually a bit of a selfish cook because I like to cook what I enjoy eating. So I would write it down, make it, and see how people responded to it. But also my best thing was traveling and tasting new dishes and coming home and trying to recreate them. And now it's changed because I don't eat trafe anymore, so it's a bit difficult. But in America, there are outstanding kosher restaurants, so there are like places you can still go. And I think I learned a lot by traveling and tasting different foods.
And you, Sharon?
I think exactly what Karen said is that when you go out and you recreate something that you've tasted, because you can actually still have that taste in your mouth, is what you want to put into a book. But for me, it was about the accessibility of ingredients. Would people be able to find those things in the shops? Because it's all lovely if you find a wonderful sauce or you're using an ingredient that is not readily available. But people are not going to run around like we as cooks would do, because they just don't have the time. So it was making it easy for people to find the ingredients and cook them, because they all have, you know, everybody's busy.
So Sharon, how did you reconcile that need? Which Sharon's been talking about to follow trends, you know, to deliver what your audience are interested in, with your emphasis, which in a way is on the most traditional food of all. It's for the Yontavim. It's what your customers have been cooking for years.
Well, you've got to try and add a twist to it. So that's what it's all about. Adding a twist, bringing in something from natural products around you, like the South African products. I mean, I remember when my first book, there was something that we could get. It was so easy to get. It was on the kosher list. And the next thing, my book gets published a year later, not on the list anymore. It was a nightmare. Everybody was phoning me and saying, what can we use instead of? So, Sharon said you have to, you've got to work for the masses. But I think I use a lot of gluten-free products as well because my kids have got problems and allergies and this. So I do use quite a bit of gluten. Or I give a gluten, an option for gluten stuff. Like flour, mezzina, this.
Well, it strikes me that there's enormous generosity involved in writing a cookbook. You have to really want people to be able to cook well, to make your recipes as well as they possibly can. Do you ever have the impulse? We all know the person that won't give out their cheesecake recipe, or, you know. Do you ever have that impulse? Are there any that you just want to keep for yourself and your family?
Well, now I'm doing catering, so I have written quite a few new recipes, because everyone's saying, when's the second book coming out? But I'm keeping that for my catering business. So
you're keeping the recipes for your catering business?
But I've got certain friends that I can't say no to. They want the recipe and I just can't say no.
Sharon, do you ever have the impulse to just want to keep one for yourself?
Yeah, there are one or two that I've never shared, my mom's recipes. But sometimes I love sharing, because for me it's about everybody else enjoying something as much as me. So I'll just give you the recipe because I want you to be able to recreate it, you know. It's not easy to always give somebody a recipe and write it down in such a way that they'll follow it, because especially like ingredients like phyllo, for example, or where you have to have so many steps and explain the folding and whatever, it's very complicated, and that makes a recipe really long. And unless you see it being done, it's hard to follow, you know. Right. But I have got some that I've kept, but one day.
And you should.
No, I keep nothing. You can have it all. And if it doesn't work, don't cry.
I'll never forget, in the first book I wrote, it was an upside down apple cake. And I don't know where it was in the world, but this woman had made this apple cake, and she sent me an email. And every time I get an email or a phone call, I write, would you call Jamie Oliver? No. So then don't call me. Or email me. No, seriously. But anyway, so she said her cake flopped completely because I said 30 minutes or 50 minutes or whatever, and she did exactly what I said in the recipe, and it didn't work. So I wanted to say to her, you know, every oven's different. the humidity, the temperature, the altitude, whatever, you need to adjust and just use your own intuition, and you could have kept it in the oven a little bit longer, so the whole cake flopped. But that's what happens. People mm-hmm. don't really take into account that they have a hotter oven, or that their measuring cup is different. And it's true, it does make a difference, especially when you're baking. It doesn't really matter when you're cooking, because ingredients, you cook with love, so if it's a bit more of this or a bit more of that, it doesn't really matter. But I love that story, because it's always been, you know, she threw the cake out. Okay.
No, I want to come back as a dog in a Jewish home. The meat was so terrible, we threw it to the dog.
So terrible.
What did you do? Well, I cooked the brisket for half an hour. Brisket for half an hour? That needs long, slow cooking.
I think that what's happened also is, like, a lot of the young Jewish kosher families, these young girls that are coming, becoming very religious, don't want the old-fashioned kosher recipes. They don't like it. It's full of fat, and and that's what Sharon's done. She's both of you, more than me, because you both did it more for the kosher market, is made of modern kosher food that wasn't full of schmaltz. Really, I mean, when you look at chopped liver, I mean, just think about it. It's a heart attack on a plate, actually. It's the liver, the schmaltz, the fried onions, and salt.
And really, to the already.
Yeah, so now you're having, like, all these ingredients, but you modernized it, and that's what they like. But, I mean, my kids don't eat herring. You know, I love herring, but I grew up with it. I mean, you know, we know that. They won't eat that kind of food. So it's about modernizing it to the young people who will buy the books and cook.
What's it like once you've actually published your first book, it's been well received, it's gone down well, and you want to repeat the success? Because, of course, novelists can always imagine another plot or write a sequel or a trilogy, but do you ever reach a point where you think, well, you know, I've said all I know, I've told all I have, all the skills I have to impart? Or is there always another book inside you?
I think that the internet has actually killed cookbooks, really, to a certain degree. You can't, you can just go like that and you've got a recipe, and you can watch it on YouTube. You don't even need to have a book to read it from. You can actually watch it step by step. So you've got to be very clever about how you do a cookbook that will sell, because it's got to be at the right price and as good as all the international books that are around and available, like an Otto Lengi or any of those, you know. And there's a lot on the market, there really is, but I mean, how well are they selling? Because it takes a lot of money to publish a book, so is it worth it? At the end of the day, is it worth it? Are you going to make money out of it? If you're not going to make money out of it, it's actually not worth it. So what's that?
Well, I decided to self-publish. First of all, I didn't want anyone interfering in what, you know, what I do. I wanted it to be my book. And I don't know if I had the chance again. I don't know if I would self-publish
again.
And
why is that?
Because you don't have the distribution. The publishers get you into all the bookstores and all the, you know, and to do it yourself.
It's a very expensive exercise.
It's a very expensive
and
exercise.
And a lot of hard work. Yeah.
No advice. Like, you had no one advising you what to do. And it being your first book, you know, it's a big learning curve.
So do you have, and I know Sharon says this is like Sophie's Choice, do you have a favorite recipe? Or a favorite book?
Dish.
Is it like choosing a favorite child?
Yeah, it is like choosing a favorite child. My favorite meal, I can tell you, is a biltong bagel. That I like. And macaroni cheese. And toasted cheese and mushroom.
And for you too, favorite recipe, or in your case, Sharon, a favorite book?
Of my books.
Of your books.
I still think my first book had the best recipes. I mean, it's out of print, so if you do get it, we have got copies in America, so I bring them back here. What was the best recipe? That's not from that book. The baklava ice cream was a very good recipe. The ribs were very good, and the minestrone soup in the first book was a very good recipe, the country minestrone soup. But I don't have a favorite. I love all kinds of things. I love sushi, actually. I love Japanese food. So for me, it's about fresh salmon or fresh fish, and I love that.
And for you, Karen, favorite?
It's hard to choose because every recipe in that book I love. Otherwise, I wouldn't have given it a chance.
Right.
So it's very hard to choose.
Okay. Well, that leads to my next question, which is, do you have a one top cooking tip? I mean, I know you have many, but is there one tip that you think you would give to someone starting out or someone experienced?
I would tell, taste your food
while you're cooking.
Taste your food. Do not serve something you haven't tasted. And I understand, like, my daughters are very frum, so I do understand they're making chicken soup or they're making a meat dish and they don't want to be flashy so they can't taste it. So it is complicated. It does create a problem.
Vegetarian.
Yeah, but you have to taste. Otherwise, I don't know.
I think tasting is a very important part of cooking, but I think that just seasoning with salt, you don't need any other ingredients, just very good natural salts like Himalayan salt, which I use a lot of, is the most essential ingredient in the kitchen. That and olive oil and lemons. Yeah.
And
lemons
and my favorite.
And what?
No,
lemons, olive oil, and Himalayan salt. That's it. And that's
not garlic.
I do use garlic, but it's not my essential ingredient. You know, I mean, I think it does add flavor, but if I had to use anything, it would be salt, really, over any other ingredient, because it brings out the flavor of food. It really does.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, that's where I got a pinch of, because I believe a sweet dish needs a pinch of salt. Mm-hmm. And a savory dish needs a pinch of sugar.
The army marches on its stomach, and so does a community. Join Sharon Lurie Tuesdays at 11 a.m. for the Chai FM Cooking Corner. Come hungry.
Well, it's Cooking Corner time again and recipe time again. I hope you enjoyed that clip. It was from the launch of the Jewish Book Week this week, and we had some fun, and I hope you wrote down a couple of those tips. It seems as though it is a pinch of salt in sweet and a pinch of sugar in savory, which is what I've always said. Always put a pinch of salt in your ice cream or whatever you're making. And then whenever you're doing something tart like tomatoes or something like that, savory, pinch of sugar. That helps. So let me share a recipe from Karen's book, which is a pinch of. Karen Malamed, and this is her sticky sesame chicken. So it serves 12 people, and the chicken can be barbecued or pan grilled a few hours ahead and reheated in the sauce before serving. The sticky sauce can be prepared up to one day ahead, covered and refrigerated. The sesame seeds can be toasted up to 2 days ahead, covered and stored at room temperature. So what you'll need is 3 chickens portioned, a little bit of sunflower oil frying, and freshly ground sea salt, and 1/2 cup of sesame seeds. For the sticky sauce, you'll need 1.5 cups vinegar, 1.5 cups sugar. I would imagine that is brown vinegar to get that brown sort of look. 1.5 cups sugar. Could also use brown, I'm sure. 1/4 cup of fresh lemon juice. 2 tablespoons soy sauce. 2 to 3 fresh chilies, coarsely chopped. 1 clove of garlic, coarsely chopped. 1 teaspoon of fresh ginger, crushed. Salt to taste. 1 pinch of black pepper. 15 grams of fresh coriander, coarsely chopped, and 1 cup of mayonnaise. What you would do is you would clean, wash, and rub the chicken well, then halve the breasts. Yeah, because those breasts are quite large, so halve them and rub with the oil and season lightly with salt. Barbecue the chicken bone side down first on a low to medium flame, until well browned on both sides and cooked through. Karen also likes to brine a lot as I do. I think it just gives it such a wonderful taste. Alternatively, you can preheat a cast iron frying pan greased with nonstick spray on high heat. Then you lower the heat to medium and pan grill the chicken in batches, bone side down first, until browned on both sides and cooked through. Lightly toast the sesame seeds in a deep frying pan or on medium heat and stir continuously, then you set them aside. So you just toast them. You don't have to put oil in. You just toast them in the frying pan and they will brown up because they have natural oil inside. Okay, then what you would do with the sticky sauce is you'd bring all of the sauce ingredients except the fresh coriander and the mayonnaise to the boil in about a 28 centimeter frying pan on high heat for 5 minutes, stirring often. Okay, so it's your vinegar, sugar, lemon juice, soy, chilies, garlic, ginger, salt to taste, and a pinch of pepper. Put that all into your 28 centimeter frying pan on high heat, and you just cook that, stirring it all the time for 5 minutes. And then you allow it to cool, and you transfer it to a food processor. Add the coriander and the mayonnaise and whiz until smooth. Add half of the sauce to a large frying pan or a wok. Bring to the boil and add half of the barbecue or pan-grilled chicken, stirring continuously until the chicken is well coated in the caramelized sticky sauce. Remove and repeat with the balance of the chicken and sauce, cleaning the pan or wok in between if necessary. Okay, and you just transfer the chicken to a platter, drizzle over any sauce remaining in the frying pan or the wok, and top with sesame seeds. Doesn't that sound delicious? Well, now I have Sharon's minestrone, country minestrone soup to share with you. And this is what you'll need. So if you've got your pens and paper ready, otherwise I will give it to somebody, our producer, somebody to upload it for you. And it is 1/4 cup of olive oil, 30 grams of butter or margarine. You can use cardon or whatever you want to keep it paraff. 2 onions chopped, 3 large carrots coarsely chopped, 3 sticks of celery coarsely chopped. And that's a nice mirepoix. And that is to know a wonderful base for almost anything is your onions, carrots, and celery. Then you also need to coarsely chop 3 potatoes, 4 medium baby marrow chopped into chunks, 100 grams of green beans cut into small pieces, 4 to 5 spinach leaves finely shredded, 4 chicken or vegetable stock cubes, 1/2 butternut cooked and cut into small pieces, 3 liters of boiling water, and 4 vegetable stock cubes or 3 liters of vegetable stock. You'll also need 2 tins of whole peeled tomatoes chopped with the liquid. I always like to use Italian ones. I think they're lovely and rich. You'll also need 1/2 cup, of tomato puree. Not tomato paste, tomato puree. Coarse salt and black pepper. Parmesan cheese grated is optional. So if you want to keep it paraff, you don't add the Parmesan cheese. Heat the oil and butter in a large pot. You add the onions and you cook that over medium heat until golden brown. You add the carrots and you cook that for further 2 to 3 minutes, stirring occasionally. And you add the remaining vegetables, sauteing them for a few minutes to soften them. Lastly, add stock and water, tomatoes, tomato puree, salt and pepper for seasoning. You cover the pot, bring it to the boil, then lower the temperature, and you simmer it for about 1.5 to 2 hours or until soup has thickened. And if desired, you can halve the soup and liquidize to thicken it and then return it to the pot with the remaining half of all those lovely coarsely chopped up vegetables. And you can serve it with optional Parmesan cheese. Now this soup freezes very well and it's delicious. I've made it and it's wonderful. So there are 2 recipes for our special chefs that we had at the launch of Book Week. And just after the break, I'll be coming back with another couple of recipes for Pinotage Day.
army marches on its stomach, and so does a community. Join Sharon Lurie Tuesdays at 11 a.m. for the Chai FM Cooking Corner. Come hungry.
Welcome back to the Cooking Corner. I'm Sharon Lurie, the Kosher Butcher's wife, and we've been sharing recipes and beautiful challah recipes and salad recipes and sticky sesame chicken recipes and soup. I mean, you're going to have the best Shabbos ever with all these gorgeous recipes. Now, our very own grape gets its spotlight with International Pinotage Day this weekend. Now, I must say, I learned quite a bit about Pinotage this week because I didn't know that it was actually Pinotage is a national treasure, the Pinotage grape, national treasure of South Africa. It is something we are immensely proud of and is known internationally as South Africa's signature red wine grape. Okay, now the wine, they say it's described as a deep red with a smoky, bramble, earthy kind of flavor to it. Unfortunately, I don't drink red wine. I do cook with red wine, and I have cooked with it before, so I will be sharing a recipe with you. But I'm sure you've heard on my previous shows a lady by the name of Eunice Racheli Molefi, and she's the author of the recipe book South African Culinary Heritage. And she's my go-to lady. When it comes to traditional African culture in the culinary world, that's who I turned to. So we were chatting this weekend about National Pinotage Day, and she told me that she felt it imperative for all South Africans to appreciate and support their national culinary treasure, the grape, and especially the one that makes our famous Pinotage. And red wine has traditionally, she said, has not been explored to its full extent. So here's what she's going to be doing to increase awareness within her community.
I want us to understand that wines really form part of our culinary heritage.
Right.
So we need to embrace it. So in terms of production, 80% of the wines are produced, number one, by cooperatives. So meaning that it's a very good industry for small businesses. And therefore, we need to embrace this. And approximately 340 million liters of wine is exported to the international market annum. We're not exploring the variety of wines that we have. And that is why I came up, even though my book is on food, I decided to include wine in the book. It's because we are not exploring it. So we are just stuck with the semi-sweet wine, but we are not exploring all the other wines. But in culturally, the red wine in particular, because our main ingredient is red meat. The red wine is supposed to be paired with most of our main ingredient, which is main red meat. Okay. But there's lack of knowledge. We don't know about the wines, and therefore, because we don't know, Sharon, we don't explore. The one thing that has always been done on our heritage tables has always been the sparkling wine when we celebrate. That we've embraced fully. And then the white wine, because it's easy on the palate, you'll generally find it on the table. But the red wines, we are slowly introducing them. And I believe, you know, we're celebrating this day as a Pinotage wine. We will learn to embrace more of the red wine. But typically, on average, you'll always find white wine, you'll find a sparkling wine. And I want us to explore the red wine. Over the weekend,
yes,
I'll be at Indaba giving book talks, specifically talking about the wine pairing. I'll be talking about the red wine. I'll be at Indaba Hotel Saturday and Sunday lunch, dinner, on both days. Yeah.
Hopefully you'll get everybody to start enjoying a lovely glass of red wine. I believe I actually don't drink red wine, but maybe I'll try it over the weekend just because it's National Pinotage Day.
Yes, so we all have to have a glass.
We all have to have a glass and get our palates used to it, because this is one of South Africa's largest exports. So it was great speaking to you, Eunice, and I'm sure I will be in touch with you shortly again. And have a great weekend. And that is what Eunice is going to be doing for her community, to try and teach them more, to acquire a palate for Pinotage red wine. So I thought, well, you know, the only Pinotage that I know that is kosher is Becksburg. And I spoke to Simon Beck about our wonderful Pinotage kosher red wine. Hi, Simon. Thank you for joining us on Chai FM, taking the time out to to us. Simon, you are from Becksburg, and I believe that I'm going to have to try red wine. I actually drink white, but this weekend I've made a promise that I will try, because I believe it's National Pinotage Day. And
it is indeed.
And I'm going to be trying your wine. So, okay, so tell me a little bit about the Pinotage grape. I didn't know that it was mainly grown in South Africa. Is this correct?
Yeah, it's basically South Africa's only real indigenous grape, if you can call it like that. So it came into being in 1925 when Professor Perrold at Stellenbosch University crossed two different grapes. So it's Pinotage is a crossing between Pinot Noir, which you probably heard of, and then another grape called Cinsault. But Cinsault is also known as Hermitage in South Africa. So if you combine Hermitage and Pinot Noir, you get Pinotage.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay. So now, let's say I walk into a liquor store and I see two bottles of Becksburg Pinotage.
Mm-hmm.
One has the Beth Din logo, on the other one is plain, doesn't have the Beth Din stamp on. What makes a wine kosher? What do you do differently than you would to a regular wine?
Yeah, sure. So basically, up until the point where the grapes are brought into the cellar, it's essentially the same. But once the grapes are in the cellar and the skin of the grape has been crushed and the juice exposed, then in the cellar it's exclusively handled by observant Jews. And so we've got Mashgiach, who comes out to the farm and essentially manages the entire process on our behalf, and we use, you know, separate tanks and separate barrels, and the area is sort of closed off. And the wine also undergoes a flash pasteurization. So we make what you call Mauvachal kosher wines, and that refers to the fact that they've been flash pasteurized. And then after that, anybody is allowed to handle the wine, so to say, and it remains kosher.
Uh-huh. And how long does this whole process start from the minute you've picked the grapes until it's bottled?
Yeah, so in the case of the Pinotage, we would release our 2018 vintage, you know, something like 12 months after we picked the grape.
Uh-huh. So we'll be tasting what, the 2017 now?
Correct.
Or if somebody's kept a couple of bottles, it will be even better. Does it get better with age?
Exactly. Yeah. No, I mean, a couple of years of age definitely can benefit the wine for sure.
Right. Okay. Simon, thank you so much for talking to us. And
excellent. Yeah.
Hopefully it will be a wonderful Pinotage weekend for all.
Great. Thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you.
All right. Take care.
Bye.
Cheers. Bye.
Welcome back to the Cooking Corner. I'm Sharon Lurie, the Kosher Butcher's wife, and we're talking a little bit about red wines and how to get a taste and palate for it. And difficult for me, but I promise I'm going to try and have a sip of it. Now, I don't condone or endorse the excessive use of alcohol, but a glass around the braai or in a meat dish is okay. In fact, if you cook wine or alcohol in a meat dish, the alcohol cooks out anyway once you start boiling it. But here goes with my Pinotage-inspired beef dish. So you'll need 2 kilograms of raisin rib. Okay, so for the overseas listeners, that is chuck off the bone. Or you can use a cut of meat that you would cook low and slow. Salt and pepper. 2 tablespoons of oil, 3 large onions chopped. Onions give it a wonderful flavor. I love onions in any dish. 3 sticks of celery chopped, 3 carrots chopped, quite large carrots, 2 tablespoons of brown sugar, 1 teaspoon of garlic, 1 teaspoon of dried thyme, 500 mils. Are we having a problem with the speaker? Okay. I hope you heard that. So it's a teaspoon of garlic, 1 teaspoon of dried thyme, 500 mils of Backsberg Pinotage wine. If there's any left over, you can drink it while you're making the dish. 2 tablespoons of tomato paste, 1 beef broth cube dissolved in 1 cup of boiling water, 4 medium-sized potatoes, cut in half. Okay, so we have to go to an ad break quickly, and then I'm going to come back with the method.
An army marches on its stomach, and so does a community. Join Sharon Lurie Tuesdays at 11 a.m. for the Chai FM Cooking Corner. Come hungry.
Welcome back. I'm Sharon Lurie, the Kosher Butcher's Wife, and we are talking about a Pinotage-inspired beef dish. So, as I was saying before the break, we needed 2 kilos of raisin rib, which is chuck off the bone, salt and pepper, 2 tablespoons of oil, 3 large onions chopped, 3 sticks of celery chopped, 3 carrots chopped, 2 tablespoons of brown sugar, 1 teaspoon of garlic, 1 teaspoon dried thyme, 500 mils of Pinotage wine, 2 tablespoons of tomato paste, and that's, it's normally 2 tablespoons in those sachets, and a beef broth cube dissolved in 1 cup of boiling water. I think I need to go on to the children's show in the afternoon. Beef broth cube. 4 medium-sized potatoes cut into half. It depends on how big they are, or into quarters. So you wash the meat, you dry it, and you sprinkle it with salt and pepper. Then you brown the meat in a large pot over high heat until the whole roast is nicely browned. You really want to get the whole thing brown and caramelized. Now, don't allow it to burn, because this is going to ruin the taste of the whole dish. And then you remove the meat from the pot and you set it aside in a roasting dish. Then to the same pot in which the meat was browning, we fry the onions. Whoopsie, this mic is falling down. Sorry about that. Okay, to the same pot in which the meat was browning, we fry the onions, the celery, and the carrots until the onions and celery are soft, and just scrape all those lovely bits of meat, the residue at the bottom of the pot. Scrape it all together. You add the garlic and the thyme, and you give it a good stir. And then you add the wine. And once the wine starts to boil, reduce the heat and allow it to simmer for about 20 to 25 minutes without the lid on. And this allows the alcohol to actually evaporate and the sauce to reduce. And then you pour the sauce over the meat. You add the cube, the beef broth, the tomato paste, and then pour that over the meat as well, because you need quite a bit of moisture. And you tuck in the potatoes on the side and you cook it in a preheated oven, 170 for about 4 to 4.5 hours, because you really want it lovely and soft. So now at this point, this is where we have to use our seichel, because after about 3 hours, lift the tin foil lid or the lid of the roasting pan off. And if the roast really looks like it's a bit dry, because sometimes meat gives off more liquid, potatoes absorb more of the liquid. Okay, if it looks a little bit dry, add a little bit of the water or the wine. And if it looks like it's got too much juice, then you just remove the tin foil, and this should reduce and evaporate the liquid to make it more saucy rather than more soupy. So check it after about 3 hours to see how you're lying at that point. And then I would just serve it with mustard, horseradish, favorite vegetables, and that's it. So as I said before, the I've given some recipes to Jewish Life magazine, and I will be giving you a recipe next week, because the Jewish Life magazine only comes out next Monday, and so I'm going to be giving you a recipe. I can't share the recipes yet because they're embargoed, and they were specially created for Jewish Life. So you'll have to wait until then, but I will be giving a recipe for a lovely chicken dish, which actually looked like I sliced it up. I sliced the stuffed chicken breast up to make it look like sushi, and served it on sushi rice. And I will give you that recipe once you've got the Jewish Life magazine. So it looks like our time is up. I hope you've enjoyed the show. Thank you for joining me. It's been wonderful being back here in the studio after my 1 month food vacation. And remember, it's Eat and Meet that makes this show complete.